All right, so we're here with the dude.
Dude abides.
How's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty
good. Who are you, man?
My name's Ted Newark, and I live in the Java and the .NET space. I spend about half my time in the Java world and about half my time in the .NET CLR world, and I spend the other half of my time looking at other languages, and whatever halves of my time are left, I spend with friends and family. And surprisingly, you know, there's not a lot of time left.
Interesting. So you're interested in interop between .NET and Java, or
I've spent probably the last decade and a half talking about implementing, mentoring, etc., enterprise systems. And when you get into large-scale corporations, you know, you talk about the Fortune 500s, the Fortune 5000s, they tend to have some Java over here, some .NET over here, some C++ over here, a little Delphi hanging out here in the corner, you know, some old VB6 code. And it's a huge challenge to try to bring all this stuff together. So, you know, for pretty much ever since the .NET platform came out, I've been talking to people about how Java and .NET can work together. Not just those two platforms, but you know, let's be honest, that's where about 85 to 90% of the work is in terms of trying to get platforms to talk to one another. And, you know, there's a variety of different ways to do that. And it's a very, very long story that you probably don't want to hear right now.
So we're here. Clearly, we're at something called Lang.net.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned to me that you had given a talk in Zurich recently.
Yes, at the Jazoon conference.
The Jazoon conference, where you made the statement that the next 5 years is going to be all about languages.
About programming languages specifically, right.
What do you mean by that? Why do you think you can say that?
Well, historically, if you look at our industry, there's been this huge disconnect between the practitioners, right, the guys who, you know, get stuff done, and the academics who are thinking about how we get stuff done and thinking about ways to try to make it better and to better capture certain concepts and so on and so on and so on. And more so in this industry than any other that I've ever seen, the academics and the practitioners just don't talk to one another. I mean, one of the things, Joel Polbar even makes this point in his February 2008 article in MSDN Magazine. People who write compilers are somehow mysterious and scary, and they live in a slightly different plane of existence from the rest of us programmers because they use really, really foreign tools like Lex and Yak, and they talk about, you know, recursive descent parsers. And this is all stuff that if you went through your computer science curriculum, you tried to forget as quickly as possible once you got onto the real world and had to start thinking about how do I pull data from this relational database and display it on this web page. And there's just been this huge disconnect, and I believe that a large part of that stems from the fact that the academic will go work on, say, a new language or a new idea of looking at the world, right, which is generally expressed through languages, but not always. So he works on idea X, and he wants to prove the theory, so to speak. So he writes language X, and historically that has meant that he had to write the code generator for it. He had to write the garbage collector for it if it was a garbage collected platform. He had to write the library loader. He had to write the platform interop facilities if there were any, and so on and so on and so on. He had to build a whole bunch of stuff that was effectively outside the scope of what it was he really wanted to do. And as most programmers will admit, if it's not something you really want to do, you tend not to spend a lot of time on it. You tend not to really make it, you know, a strong part of what you're interested in. And so for years, we've had all these languages that run, you know, very interesting languages, but run on their own platform, right? They don't know how to talk to a relational database. They don't know how to, you know, parse and emit XML. They don't know, I mean, you know, they don't know XML, so they clearly don't know SOAP and any of the other connective tissue that we use to glue some of this stuff together. Over here in the practitioner world, we will, you know, if you are one of those adventurous types who goes and reads an academic paper and actually bothers to learn terms like the pi calculus, the lambda calculus, and these other things that are just foreign language, to, you know, even to us programmers, mm-hmm. right? If it's a foreign language, you know it must be obscure. And you struggle with that, and you learn it, and you say, wow, this is really cool stuff, and I'm going to go and pull that new compiler down. I'm going to go pull that new environment down, and I'm going to start using it, and wow, it completely solves my problem. And the IT guys tell you to go to hell because there is no way that they're willing to put yet another language, yet another platform, yet another whatever mm-hmm. into their organization without significant, you know, upscale management buyout. Mm-hmm. This has actually been one of the principal holding back factors for Ruby and Rails is because Ruby represents a new platform. Hmm. Now, note when I say this, I'm speaking specifically of the original Ruby interpreter, right? The Matz's Ruby machine, MRV, Matz's Ruby MRI, Matz's Ruby interpreter. Hmm. Matz is the original creator of the Ruby language. When we start talking about Ruby and Rails running on top of the JVM, a la Charles Nutter's work with JRuby, mm-hmm. or we talk about Ruby and Rails running on top of the CLR, a la John Lamb's work with the DLR, mm-hmm. or Wayne Kelly's work with Ruby.net, the compiler, now you have a mature platform on which to execute this stuff, and now you can say, you know, I'm going to go learn this Ruby language because it does express some different ways of doing things mm-hmm. that traditional C-sharp and VB code just doesn't get into. Hmm. And yet, at the end of the day, it all turns into IL. And I can plug it in on top of ASP.NET. I can plug it into ADO.NET. I can write a WinForm. I can use WPF. I can connect it with WCF. Hmm. It can live inside of a workflow. Hmm. You still have all of that ecosystem that says, this is real-world production platform, yeah. even if it's, you know, experimental, don't tell anybody, code living on top of that rich platform. Hmm. So because we have these two ubiquitous platforms for which it is so easy to write a language, it essentially reduces a huge pain point for experimentation and, more importantly, getting that feedback. Mm-hmm. Because now if we assume you're a researcher and you want to experiment with, you want to experiment with Coke-oriented programming, right, where everything is, in fact, a keyword around the, you know, my favorite drink of choice. Uh-huh. You can create said language. You can have it generate JVM bytecode, or you can have it generate CIL. You can put it out there, and people can say, oh, this is great. This solves this problem so well, but it would be nice if you could do this as well. And you say, oh, okay, cool. And now what's happening is that critical feedback loop gets closed, because for the last 20 or 30 years, I believe that feedback loop has been fundamentally broken. Where we'll try something. I mean, the last serious work that came out of academia that really had an impact on practitioners is C++, and that was 20 years ago. Java, .NET, these were all basically, they were influenced certainly mm-hmm. by academic sources, mm-hmm. right? Anders and James Gosling and so forth certainly knew the prior art and certainly borrowed some of those concepts and so forth, but really, in terms of languages, they've all been footnotes on, you know, what Bjarne did with C++. And even he will say that's essentially Self and C coming together, Simula and C coming together with a few other things that he added on. And we've been living that object-oriented lifestyle for the last 15 years, mm-hmm. and people are hungry. They're interested in seeing what new things can emerge out of this because, you know, it didn't happen so much in the .NET space, but in the Java space, we had AspectJ, mm-hmm. which Jim Huguenin was actually a very deep part of. And the adoption didn't occur at the scale that the AspectJ guys would have liked, mm-hmm. but in terms of the impact it had through the rest of the Java ecosystem, right, we taught, you know, the whole reason we have Spring, the whole reason we can talk about some of this middleware and some of these container concepts is because AspectJ gave us a new lexicon and a new way of thinking, and cross-cutting concerns is a term that the Aspect guys coined. Hmm. We're clearly looking for something beyond the object paradigm to essentially go up a level, if you will, on the abstraction tree. But we don't know what that is yet. And the dynamic language guys are experimenting with that, and obviously the Aspect guys are experimenting with that. And that's why this is having these two platforms is so powerful, because now I can let Microsoft and Sun worry about making the platform run better. I generate to this intermediate forum that sits on top of their platform, and I get just for free whatever additional stuff they introduce.
Hmm.
So given that, you know, compiler construction tools are so much easier to work with now. I mean, it's worlds beyond Lex and Yak. Harry Pearson is going to be giving a talk here about doing some parsers from within F#. Gilad Braca was just talking about parser combinators, which says we don't have to go down that code generation step. They basically look like libraries. And there's a similar one for Java and .NET called JParsec and NParsec, which is open source. There's all these tools out there to make it so easy for you to get started with your own language. Why wouldn't you? Especially when you've got things like the DLR.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to do the interpreted thing, oh, you just put it into a tree form, we'll handle the rest.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, from a general purpose programmer's perspective, I don't think creating languages is something that your average programmer really has a profound interest in. I mean,
see, and I would disagree with that.
Let's talk about general purpose people.
Okay.
Who are writing code,
right.
Say, writing Channel 9 or writing, you know, things in Windows, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think like the some of the kernel developers want to write their own language?
Yes.
You do.
Because I think that, and let me be precise about what I'm suggesting here. I'm not suggesting that, you know, the ubiquitous, like, you know, two or three VB programmers working for a company of 5 people or 10 people or 50 people are going to sit down and build their own general purpose programming language.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that we are constantly searching for new tools to solve problems.
Sure.
And one of the things that we have discovered is that it can be very, very useful if you can build a language that directly models the problem.
Absolutely.
Think about Excel for a moment, right? How powerful is Excel because of that formula language?
Mm.
Now think about the overwhelming success in the Microsoft space of VBA. Mm. VBA is essentially a language that's designed to glue together components, Office components, to create some very powerful solutions,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, what I'm suggesting is that for years, the ability to create that additional extension capability has been reserved for the guru programmer.
Yeah.
And I think now what's happening is it's a democratization of that concept. It's now saying, look, if you don't have to have gotten a PhD from MIT to create your own language and compiler. That's really a myth.
Mm.
To build a very simple language can be done in 90 minutes using some of the tools that are available. Mm. Now, there's some conceptual stuff you will want to know. There's some terminology you will want to know. Just like if you want to pull something out of a relational database, you have to know row, table, and you have to be at least, you know what people are talking about when they say relational algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you mean selects and inserts. Oh, okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be at least conversant with some of that terminology if you're going to read what other people have written on the subject. But the ability to walk up to your users and say, all right, rather than trying to craft a GUI that will accommodate every possible need you could ever have,
mm-hmm.
let me build a tool. Let me build a library. Let me build a whatever. And so I'll build this core engine. And I'll put a GUI on top of it that handles the cases where you don't know necessarily what it is you want to do. You want to have sort of a sandbox in which to play.
Mm-hmm.
But as you start getting comfortable with this core engine and what it does, the core engine is non-GUI. So now you can drive this from, say, PowerShell. And now you can drive this, you know, one of the very first programming steps people take down the path of becoming a programmer is learning their command shell, learning how to write batch files, right? Or learning VBA, because VBA is essentially the command shell for Office. So now we'll extract that and we'll say, all right, now you can go ahead and use the engine directly from within PowerShell. Or from within, you know, even from within your GUI app. Let me give you a scripting facility inside of there. And that all of a sudden takes these people who are, you know, slaves to the GUI and allows them to start using your application in ways you never imagined. this allows emergent behavior to come out. And as you start to see people, everybody's doing the same block of five lines of code, you go, that's something that I can fold directly back into the engine and make things easier for them. And now all of a sudden you're responding to what it is they need as expressed by the scripts they write. Mm. Right? I mean, this is just one aspect of it. The gaming community has been doing this for decades. As a matter of fact, Ken Levy, a buddy of mine who works with the VSX team, the VSIP guys and so forth, was just showing me a project they commissioned. Brace yourself. It's a World of Warcraft plugin that lives inside a Visual Studio and gives you all the studio goodness around the scripting language that's used in World of Warcraft called Lua, which is very, very popular in a large number of different games. Hmm. But essentially, this is Visual Lua Express themed for World of Warcraft.
Nice.
And they've already gotten something like, you know, 50,000, 500,000, whatever hits. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're a WoW player, you know, mm-hmm. go to codeplex.com and look it up, because I think it's like the top ranked download at this point or something.
Nice.
But this is just one aspect of the Lua language. It's a general purpose language, but it's very well tuned for doing games. I mean, the Doom engine, right? It had its own C language. Later was called Quake C. Mm. The Unreal Engine has its own language. Most of your gaming engines, particularly if they have scenarios, mm-hmm. I mean, people have to play test that stuff and they have to tune it to make sure it works right.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than going in and modifying, you know, C and C++ code, they write the engine in C and C++, driving all the graphics, etc., and then they build scenarios or whatever you will using these scripting languages that drive the engine. It's a very old pattern. It's just, we haven't embraced it as much as we could or should in the rest of the programming community.
Interesting. So you're talking specifically about lightweight languages, scripting languages, right?
Lightweight is a dangerous term.
Okay, let me back up. So if I look at a language like Newspeak that Gilad was talking about, okay, that's sort of a, I wouldn't call it heavyweight, but I would call it like a very different language.
That's clearly, I mean, there's languages for programmers and there's languages for people who aren't necessarily programmers.
Okay.
And what's happening right now in terms of the world around us, in terms of the industry, is people are calling those languages for people who aren't necessarily programmers. They're calling those domain-specific languages.
Got it.
Which, DSLs. Well, this unfortunately conflicts directly with the DSL tools package that Microsoft makes available, because what those guys are after is much more in the realm of modeling, you know, trying to model the world and trying to give you a model that you can operate on and so forth.
Hmm.
What the other half of the community refers to as DSLs used to be called little languages in the Unix world, right? And these are things like, you know, Sed and Awk and, you know, some of these other tools that they were very, very special purposed to a particular task. And so you picked that up, you learned how to do it. Regular expressions is arguably a little language specifically for picking stuff out of text.
Yeah.
And so in some cases, these non-programmer languages, these DSLs, may be very, very programmer-centric, right? Which is why we have to be a little careful with the taxonomy and the nomenclature here.
Sure.
But one of the areas where DSLs, little languages, custom languages, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
has been very powerful has been in the area of telecom provisioning.
Hmm.
I don't have the citation handy because I read this like 10 years ago. But the major telcos have somebody created a language specifically for provisioning their equipment. Now, interestingly enough, we hear from Ericsson that they created a language to deal with a lot of the switching of information across the network, and that language is Erlang, which is gathering some buzz about it because of its support for high degrees of concurrency and so forth. I don't know if these are one and the same thing, but my point simply is, here is a language
mm-hmm.
that was created to deal specifically with a problem, that is to say concurrency. dude wrote it as part of his graduate thesis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Joe Armstrong.
Right. Took it with him to Ericsson.
And modified it.
You know, did the program while he was at Ericsson. I don't know the full background there. Mm. But here's a language that clearly grew up around this idea of dealing very, very strongly with concurrency that is slowly managing to leak back into the practitioner space, because obviously we care about concurrency in mm-hmm. the face of, you know, multiple core CPUs and stuff like that.
Sure.
And interestingly enough, this is an area that the academics have spent a tremendous amount of energy thinking about and experimenting with these particular problems. And historically, you know, the practitioner community has said, meh, when there's yeah. a Java version, a .NET version, or a C++ version, you let me know. But until then, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Because that's what those are the tools we need in order to get stuff done. Now, thanks to the JVM and the CLR, we can really start to take some of these concepts and filter them back into the community. One great case in point, Microsoft Research, Eric Meyer, mm-hmm. was working on a language called C Omega. C Omega was an interesting blend of some concurrency concepts called chords, as well as the idea of trying to integrate, as Eric put it, rectangles, circles, and triangles. He wanted to integrate objects, relational data, and hierarchical data, XML. Well, the second part of that was mm-hmm. effectively spun off into what would become Link in C# 3.0. But the first part, the concurrency part, kind of got left behind. And C Omega is still there if you want to download it. It still compiles for the CLR. So if you want to write some C Omega code today, you can. It's just Microsoft has said, it was a research project, it served its purpose, we're done. Mm-hmm. But the concept of chords mm-hmm. has now been pulled out into a library called joins, because technically this is what's known as the join calculus amongst the academics. Mm. And the joins library runs on top of Visual Studio 2005 or 2008, and you can use it today, nice. Production code. If that way of managing concurrency appeals to you as a mm-hmm. programmer, the fact that it comes from Microsoft Research, who cares? Mm-hmm. It's a .NET assembly. It's a library that I can use like any other. Mm-hmm. So there's this real power now for us to tap into, which is to say all of those things that the academics are working on, mm-hmm. and we can tap into that, we can experiment with it, we can offer feedback back. You know, and this is kind of what the Lang.NET Symposium is about, is offering some feedback back into the system, if you will.
Sure.
And it's just, you know, this is just one aspect of closing that loop. The other being, I'm going to sit down with, you know, one of the guys here was doing a presentation on a parser to make things easier to do, you know, lexing and scanning of tokens. Pull that out, have it generate an AST, right? Or you can use F# to do this. Hmm. Then in turn, take that AST and plug that into the DLR for interpretation, or plug it into the Phoenix toolkit, which is Microsoft's compiler backend, mm-hmm. which will be the backend that they use to compile Windows 7. So this is not going to be just some research project that has no applicability.
Sure.
I mean, you know, if you're interested in tools, mm-hmm. and lots of developers are interested in tools, if only to make their own lives easier, this is a hell of a time to be a programmer. It's great.
Right on. And you have some, as you've been mentioning, it's interesting. I see an interesting sort of, I wouldn't call it a, I guess it is sort of a paradox, because what, with the CLR, and even in the Java world, but to a lesser extent, I guess you could argue, or the base class library that's provided with the framework is pretty gigantic, mm-hmm. And offers an immense amount of functionality.
Mm-hmm.
That the language actually becomes sort of like a thin layer on top of this blob of functionality. And so if you get too caught up with languages, it is an interesting thing, because as the foundation or the platform becomes much more powerful, I mean, what if the CLR handled concurrency for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why doesn't a virtual machine take care of cores?
The danger of that is that you start headed down the path of the one true language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this idea that a lot of young programmers have, you know, as they're going through college, or they come out of college, they get into the real world, and they start thinking about, you know, Do I want to write code in Java? Do I want to write code in C#? Do I want to write it in C++? There's kind of this sense, and I don't know where it comes from. I would love to know, because then I would kill him. but there's this sense that says there's one language that, you know, this is the programming language that God intended, right? Mm-hmm. This is the Uber language, the one from which all other languages are just pale imitations, right? The amber of the programming languages, if you will, if there are any Roger Zelazny fans out there. And everything else is just kind of a pale shadow of this. And this is, I mean, if we could find that one true language, we can write everything in that one true language and, you know, the language wars are officially over. Mm. The problem with that theory is that you lose sight of the fact that programming languages, much like human languages, are expressions not just of concepts within them, but also of the environment in which they were born. Mm. Case in point, the Eskimos, right, the Aleuts of, you know, the frozen north, they have, what is it? I'm going to get the number wrong, but they have something on the order of 30 different words for snow. Why do they have 30 different words for snow? Because they really care a lot about the different kinds of snow. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't speak Aleut. I don't know what those translations are, but I'd be willing to bet there's at least some distinction for the soft white powder that falls from the sky that's really good to ski on versus the really hard frozen stuff that if you pick up and hurl at your little brother, you know, as a snowball, it's going to hurt him, potentially break skin, right? To them, snow is so much a part of their environment, so much a part of what's important to them, that they came up with different distinctions between these so that they could identify them as part of their daily lives. To us living here in Seattle, you know, we have snow, we have ice, and the rest of the distinctions are pretty meaningless.
No, I just kind of blend everything into class cloud.
Yeah, well, there you go.
It just all derives from cloud.
Yeah, if it's watery and coming down from the sky, I don't care what it is. It's precipitation.
Gray. Yeah.
Right? And this notion that we'll be able to create one programming language that somehow covers all of those different scenarios. The reason I say what you were talking about, having the virtual machine cover this problem of concurrency, is that starts to buy into that same myth that the virtual machine will be able to take care of concurrency for me automagically. There are certainly common cases where we could say, I want the virtual machine to behave this way. And in fact, there's some research going on around the notion of software transactional memory to say we want software, we want objects in memory to behave the same way that, you know, rows and tables do inside of a database. When I access it, I'm looking to take either a read or a write lock on it. If it's read, no concurrency is necessary, unless, obviously, we're in the middle of a write. If it's a write, then I have to make sure nobody else is accessing it so that I can then make my changes. Even within that, though, there's so many subtle variations, subtle plays on that, that, you know, the database guys talk about, you know, multiple reads, they talk about multiple writes, they talk about, you know, reader favored, you know, writer favored. There's so many different preferences, because then you want to start tuning. You know, if this is going to be a table that's going to be principally read, I'm going to use a different concurrency strategy, even within the database, than if this is one that's going to be principally written to. You know, lookup tables are very different from log tables. And you start to realize that the transactional idea, the transactional concept, has a tremendous amount of variation within it.
Sure.
Right? And so even there, where we have a general purpose concept for controlling concurrency, there's a lot of variations within it to try to cover those individual scenarios. So I'm sure somebody will cook up a VM that wants to take care of you know, multi-threaded slash concurrency concerns for me. And as soon as they do, I want to get as far away from it as I possibly can. Because, yeah, you could probably make it work, but you're certainly not going to be able to eke out the kind of performance that you could from it. That you could if you actually know that stuff and know how to tune it and know how to choose it and know how to transform it. And I don't need necessarily to get a hold of the threads myself and manage the locks myself. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't have this twisted desire to write multi-threaded code and using locks and so forth. But I need to be able to influence it at a relatively fine-grained level. So I don't want the VM to just take care of it as an implementation detail. Mm-hmm. I want to have that kind of control to be able to say, you know what, when you come into this method also makes use of this, this, and this. So make sure there's no currently executing code inside of those code paths that this guy could potentially conflict with. Mm-hmm. And once that's true, go ahead and let the call go through. I need to be able to control that at you know, either a coarse-grained or a fine-grained level.
Certainly. I mean, you could argue the same, not to belittle the complexity of the incredible garbage collector that exists mm-hmm. in the CLR. It's the only one that I have any experience with as far as understanding how it works.
Right.
You could argue that, you know, memory management and core management, if you will, mm-hmm. in the many-core world, it could be another very interesting problem. I mean, you could just, I'm not saying that, you just abstract developers away from the hardware, which is what you do anyway.
But interestingly enough about GC, mm-hmm. right, the garbage collector, you know, undoubtedly you've run into a situation where you had to put an object inside of a using statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you have to provide some hints to the garbage collector mm-hmm. because using actually turns into a call to dispose on an iDisposable object. And the reason is because the GC focuses entirely on memory, nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't understand file handles. He doesn't understand socket handles. He doesn't understand any of that other stuff. And using actually arguably grew out of some of the experience we had with the Java Virtual Machine, where we said, you know what, I'm gonna get a hold of a statement object, which is a relational database, you know, a connection produces statement, produces result sets, very similar to what you see in ADO.NET.
Mm.
So I'm going to get a hold of a statement, and I'm going to issue a query, and I'm going to walk through the result sets, and I'm done. I just let go of it. Garbage collection will take care of it.
Mm.
Problem is, garbage gets collected when the GC wants, mm-hmm. not when I want. And so if I do this in a tight loop, mm-hmm. I'm very quickly going to run out of statement handles because the garbage collector says, you know what, I've got plenty of objects over here that I'm collecting. That statement doesn't need to be collected yet. This is the very conversation that Chris Sells had with Brian Harry on the developmentor list way back in 2000 that led to the creation of using an iDisposable in .NET Beta 1 and Beta 2.
Mm.
Because we have to be able to influence the garbage sure. collector at times like that to deal with resources that GC doesn't know about.
Yeah.
Plus, just to make this conversation even more interesting, the GC that we see inside the CLR and the JVM is predicated on the idea that we create lots of little temporary objects. It uses what's called a generational collector. That may not hold true for other languages.
Mm.
That may not hold true for other environments. That may not hold true, for example, in a procedural language. So we may very well find within the next, you know, 10 years, if a new kind of language, you know, if a a functional language
mm-hmm.
becomes very, very popular and seems to be the next big thing, we could very well find that the current CLR GC does not work as well as we originally expected when coming from an object space. I don't want to make the assumption that sure. the GC we've got is the last one we'll ever need.
Oh,
because
it's
I'm
not.
Pretty convinced that, you know, once you start changing their assumptions,
mm-hmm.
you know, the results are not going to be pleasing.
Agree. I mean, and of course, it's also a technology that's evolving. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Patrick Dussoud was on Channel 9. There's an interview. He talks about what he's working on
mm-hmm.
for the future
mm-hmm.
as much as he can.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly that involves concurrent collections.
Oh, yeah.
There's very interesting.
The thing about this space is, you know we're not done.
Totally.
You know, guys like Jim Miller and Eric Meyer, you know, Jim Huguenin, John Lamb, they're going to be employable for a very, very long time.
It's true.
And again, this is the beautiful thing. If I create my own custom language
mm-hmm.
and I put it on top of the CLR, every time those guys make an enhancement,
it benefits me. You do.
It benefits me. And I love it. And the same thing is true of what, you know, John Rose and some of the other guys are doing with the JVM. And there it's great because they'll do something in Java and Microsoft goes, that's good, but we can make it better. And mm-hmm. so they do. And then the guys over at Java go, you know what? that's good, but we can make it better. And it just elevates each other's game, and programmers all over the world benefit. So I love the competition between these two. It's great.
Outstanding. Well, hey, man, we should get you a white Russian, dude. And hey, thank you for coming on Channel 9, man.
You bet.
Great talking to you.
Take care.
And enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's a very good conference. What's been your favorite part of it so far, real quickly?
Oh, geez. Let's see. Couple of things. Jim Huguenin, Lego Mindstorms, Balloon Animals.
Yeah, that was very...
Let's see. Wes, I can't remember his last name, talking about PHP and the fact that PHP is a stinking pile of language, his words.
Hmm.
And Galad Braca in talking about Newspeak and some of the things that he's trying to do there. So, I mean, it's all good stuff.
Typeless programming language.
Well, not even typeless, but just, you know, talking about different ways of thinking about languages, period.
Totally.
Statically typed, dynamically typed, loosely typed, strongly typed,
untyped. Very cool
Only
stuff.
Only one type. Who knows?
Well, hey, man, thank you for coming on.
Thank you.